started. So today we're going to pick up with this notion of anomalies. So this is an introduction to anomalies, and we'll be spending a fair amount of time talking about these things. So let's take, for reasons of specificity, the QCD Lagrangian, which is a sum over all the quark flavors where F is given by CABC, I guess I called it last time. These are often called F for structure constants. Not sure why I used C's. I think it was a math notation. Anyway, that's F. And capital D mu is shorthand notation for this, where the T's are generators of the group. TA, TB is ABC, TC, and I sum over repeated indices unless otherwise stated. So this sum is over the number of flavors of quarks. We know there are six in existence for sure. Maybe that's all there are. We don't know that at this point in time. But if you set the mass equal to zero for all the quarks, then you get a Lagrangian that has an enhanced degree of symmetry. You'll get a Q bar left, ID slash Q left, and you'll get one that is a Q bar right, ID slash Q right, and then of course minus a quarter the trace of F squared. And left and right mean psi left is defined by the projection using 1 minus gamma 5, and psi right is defined using a half 1 plus gamma 5. So by the Qs, I just mean a fermion wave function. Q just means quark. So the reason why this happens is that a term like this, you can show, has to break up into left bar left and right bar gamma mu right. Whereas a term like this, looks like that. So the mass term here is like a psi bar psi term. And using these relationships, psi bar psi couples psi left to psi right. Psi bar left, psi right, plus psi bar right, psi left. Whereas if you stick a gamma matrix in between them, then it's bar left with left, bar right with right. And so as a consequence, if you get rid of the mass terms, then the left and right pieces decouple from one another. And this leads to an enhanced level of symmetry that is still generally thought to be important when looking at fundamental theories of nature. I guess partly motivated by the fact we think more symmetry is better than less. So this is symmetric under the symmetry that Q prime would go to some unitary matrix in the left-handed sector, and Q right prime will be transformed by some other unitary matrix, call it U right, in the right-handed sector. So these at the moment are space-time independent matrices. This would be UNF. I don't have enough room here. This symmetry would be UN sub F cross UN sub F global symmetry that is otherwise absent if you have a mass term. In fact, if you have a mass term, then you break this symmetry to just basically half this amount, I guess. You'd have a UNF symmetry. So here you have a symmetry for the left-handed sector. You have a different symmetry for the right-handed sector of quarks. And so the entire Lagrangian will have, of course, the full QCD symmetry. So it will be crossed SU number of colors for the full Lagrangian, since we think we have three colors, n sub c is three, but you could write down a theory that had them all. So the point is this: sometimes theories lose their degree. Oh, sorry.
So just to point out the notation, is that the indices a, b mean different
things? They run over the flavor space. Yeah. If I have six quarks, they go from one to six.
If that's a different index, right?
Yes, that's the QO. Now I see the confusion. Let me fix that. You're right. Thanks for pointing that out. Let me call this, one runs out of letters here. I'd like to write a fractor, but I can't. Let me put hats on them. Those are the SU and color there. Sorry about that. My apologies. These indices run over the number of colors. Three for the real world. These indices here run over the number of flavors, which is six for the real world, at least to the best of our knowledge at this point in time. So basically, you can mix up the left-handed pieces of the quarks independently from the right-handed pieces, provided you don't have a mass term. Yeah.
Is the number of flavors completely free to specify? Like, there's nothing that...
Mathematically, yes.
Okay.
As is the number of colors. There's no a priori constraint on what those numbers should be.
And there's no relation between the number of colors and number
of colors. Not a priori. At this level. What excited people about string theory 30 years ago is this subject we're talking about led to a constraint of the type you describe. And that's what got everybody excited. Because prior to that, the symmetry group is specifiable by the user, not by any principle of logic or reason, whereas or consistency. Whereas anomalies in string theory led to a principle of consistency that specified these numbers. In fact, it specified not only the number, it specified the group to be one of five. However, that level of specification didn't quite work out the way people hoped it would 30 years ago, but nevertheless, that's it. So yeah, at this level, this and this can be any numbers I want them to be. A million, a billion, there's no a priori constraint outside of empiricism. Okay, yeah, thanks. Sorry about the notational confusion. Okay, so so sometimes theories lose their symmetry, in which case, and I'll go into detail about what that means, sometimes they lose their symmetry, or symmetries, depending, due to quantum corrections, in which case we say we have an anomaly. In other words, what's supposed to be a symmetry, what would be a symmetry if H bar were zero, is no longer a symmetry. So let's see. So we're going to look at this in a fair amount of detail to start with, but let's start with the simplest case, which is QED, and then in later times we'll build up to that. So the Lagrangian for QED is a lot simpler because the SUN color becomes a U1, and we'll stick with one flavor. So this is ID/ let's see, plus IEA/ minus a quarter F squared. And this theory, as we saw last time, has one local phase symmetry. Its psi prime is e to the I alpha of x psi, and a mu prime is equal to a mu minus 1 over e d mu of this same alpha. So if you replace, replace psi and a with psi prime and a prime, the Lagrangian looks exactly the same. And the meaning is, if I solve the equations of the theory under whatever boundary conditions, circumstances are viewed as desirable or relevant, I could get one answer, but any of you could get a different answer to that from me. And if we have solved the situation correctly, my answer would be related to yours by these transformations, provided we'd done our arithmetic correctly. That's the way, at least, I like to understand what these things mean. However, what we have here, there's no mass here. These are massless charged particles. So this would be called a U1 vector symmetry. But there is also, want to write it underneath. There's also what we will call a U1 axial symmetry, which is psi prime is e to the I theta of x gamma 5 psi, and a prime, theta doesn't depend on x yet, a prime just equals a. So this is, at this point for QED, a local symmetry. This is a global axial symmetry. So I could phase rotate left and right independently. If I broke this up using those definitions there, I could rotate the phase of the left particle opposite to that of the phase of the right particle, right-handed particle, and I would get the same thing. Whereas here, although it's local, I have to rotate the phase of the left-handed part exactly the same as the right-handed part. In the axial case, they're rotated oppositely to one another. But even though it's a global symmetry, I could gauge it, but at the moment, let's not. So even though this is a global symmetry, that still means there are conserved currents, and we have two conserved currents here. In fact, I don't think I want to write upward. Maybe I will just do that. This one has a conserved current that is psi bar e times psi bar gamma mu psi, and d mu j mu is zero. That's very straightforward to show from the equations of motion. Whereas here we have what one could call, I suppose, a JMU5 symmetry, or current, sorry, and it's psi bar gamma mu gamma 5 psi, and one can show that d mu of J mu 5 is also equal to 0. So it's very tempting to gauge that current and make this, to gauge it would mean to make this thing a function of x, to introduce some analog of this vector potential to give the thing a field strength and so on. And I sketched out last time a little bit about what that would look like. But there is a problem in doing this, which means that gauging it is maybe not so straightforward. And that is this. The problem has to do with this anomaly. So let's see, how will I say this? In QFT, psi and a mu become quantum operators. And they are linear combinations. Here I'm relying on the fact that you guys have seen QFT before. They become linear combinations of creation and annihilation operators, and the interpretation is somewhat analogous to that of, in fact, fully analogous to that of the harmonic oscillator. The creation operator gives you a quantum of energy that's interpreted as a particle, and the annihilation operator removes a quantum of energy interpreted as annihilating a particle. So the J's are made of psi's, so they also are quantum operators. So let me put that in there. J mu and J mu 5 also become quantum operators. And so the quantum corrections in general are of this form. There'll be some, in perturbation theory, they will be the expectation value of some time-ordered product of J mu, or maybe of J mu 5, times a bunch of other stuff, A nu 1, A nu 2, blah, 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 A nu, how many of these have I got? A nu n, and then I might have a psi 1 to psi m, and I might have a psi bar 1 to psi bar m. And this is time ordered, so I'm not paying attention to appropriately contracting Dirac indices, because that'll be taken care of by the Wick expansion. But in general, when you have these currents, you can consider taking either the expectation value of J with some other fields in the theory, or J mu 5 with some other fields in the theory. So is this notion of an expectation value time-ordered product familiar? This okay with everybody? Okay. So let's look at the three-point function. Which is basically the, I'm going to call it gamma mu nu lambda, and it's going to depend on x0, x1, and x2, three space-time points, and it will be the time-ordered product of three quantum fields, and the one I'm interested in is j mu 5 of x0, a nu of x1, and a lambda of x2.
What does that even mean?
Well, okay, so that's why I asked if you were familiar with that. So what it means is that the way, Let me draw a picture up there since I have space. So the context of this statement is within scattering theory. So the idea is you've got a bunch of stuff coming in from the past, interacting, and then going out into the future. Who knows how many, you know, lots of things can happen. So the idea is that out here, everything is idealized as a free particle state, and likewise when they come out as well. So the idea is you've got stuff coming in, interacting, flying away. What's coming in is regarded as a free plane wave state. What's going out is regarded as a free plane wave state. And the quantity called the S matrix, it tells you how you go from here to there. This is where the interactions are. And this is given in terms of a power series in the coupling described by Feynman diagrams. Is that familiar territory? So each term in the series can be, oh, I guess I covered it up. Each term in the series can be understood as a vacuum expectation value of a time-ordered product of things of the type I described. So that's what I mean by a quantum correction. So the simplest thing that would happen would be, you know, let's say I have two fermions coming in and two fermions going out. Well, in QED, the simplest thing that happens is they just miss each other, right? The next simplest thing that happens would be that they could exchange a photon. And then the next simplest thing that happens could be some kind of loop correction, say something like this. Plus, of course, lots of other corrections. So each one of these things will be given by, so when I say quantum corrections, I mean basically corrections to the classical process, which would be this, which would be that. And these structures here are given by things of this type. And in fact, I'm going to write down the diagrammology for this in a minute, in a few minutes. But this is the the diagrams are code for a mathematical expression given by this, and ultimately this turns into the integrals in momentum space. That have you guys seen this? Yeah. Okay. Does that help?
There is it. If what we're considering
an extra j, where
In the endpoint function, in the time ordered product. Because if we're considering like j going to j,
well, but we're not. And I'll draw the picture. Okay, so maybe that'll become apparent when we look at this. It's j itself is a product of a fermion bilinear. It's a psi bar psi kind of quantity. So let me in fact draw the picture, and then I hope that'll address your question. This thing in diagram language is equal to this will be nu, this will be lambda. I'll say this is P1 going in, I'll say this is P2 going in, and I'll call this J mu 5, and then I have the cross term. And I'll call this K. I'm going to write down what this is in a minute. So what one way to think about this is you can imagine, suppose J mu 5, whatever's causing it, is sitting still. It's like a blob of axial charge. It's like a blob of J mu 5 charge, just the way J mu, what is J mu for electromagnetism? Well, if there's no velocity to the fermions, then you've got a blob of charge. So this is like a blob of gamma 5 charge, whatever the heck that is. So this blob of charge just sits there through time, and a pair of photons can interact with it. Well, how could they interact with it? Well, this is the only way possible to leading order, because photons don't directly, photons only couple to J via the fermions. There is, of course, well, these photons don't feel J mu 5 at all. They only feel J mu. J mu 5 is not gauged. So the photons would feel J mu directly, but not J mu 5. However, indirectly, they do feel or interact with J mu via these diagrams. So a pair of photons can come in, and if I had a blob of J mu 5 charge, classically, the photons would just go right through it. They would never know about it. But quantum mechanically, they could emit, if you want to think about it, in terms of time, one photon could emit a particle-antiparticle pair. The antiparticle is absorbed by one, the other photon, which emits it, and both of those go into the source, energizing the source. This is the same kind of logic used with the anomalous magnetic moment for the electron, where you have J mu, and we have, in this case, a fermion can come in and go out. But there's a quantum correction to this process where this fermion can decide to emit a photon before interacting with the source, and then it goes on its way, but it reabsorbs the photon, and this gives rise to the anomalous magnetic moment of the electron. Has that been done ever for you guys? Oh, okay. So there's a contextual element here. Let's see. Maybe I better spend a little bit on this, a couple of minutes on this. Okay, so let me talk about the J mu current. It's psi bar gamma mu psi, and that's the real world electric current that's running the lights, running my, you know, the computer, not running the clock, that's probably mechanical. No, that's a battery. Even the battery and the clock. It's all J mu 5, and J mu, or J mu. So J mu, remember, is equal to this. So if you've got charge sitting still, this is zero, and that's a blob of charge density. So you can ask, how do fermions interact with this charge density? So you could imagine this is a magnet, say. I mean, there's lots of things it could be. It could be an atom. But in the context of the anomalous magnetic moment, this is a magnet sitting still, and a fermion comes by and interacts with that magnet. And when you calculate the magnetic moment, you find this diagram gives you a magnetic moment of 2, where the magnetic moment of a particle, oh, I've got to remember this, it's sigma dot b time over 2, times G, and I'm forgetting, I think it's E over H bar C or something in units. There's a Bohr magneton here. Maybe I'll cheat and just use that. Okay, so there's a Bohr magneton, and in Dirac theory, or in any theory for any particle, what an experimentalist would say is, okay, this is fixed by the units of the problem. This is fixed in my lab. This is because the particle is spin a half. That's the spin operator. So the only thing really I'm measuring is G. How many Bohr magnetons of strength does this particle have? Now you can show that Dirac, with no QFT, gives G equals 2. And that's what I mean by this diagram. There's no loops. Effectively, this is a classical process in which the fermion flies by, interacts with the magnet, and goes on its way. And without demonstrating the calculation, you find this diagram gives you G equals 2. Another way to see this, if you've never done it, is to carry out the non-relativistic expansion of the Dirac equation coupled to a magnetic field, and you will recover G equals 2. But what happens in quantum field theory is we have quantum corrections here, and this tells me that delta G, if you like, is equal to alpha over pi, I believe. So that the total G is equal to 2 times 1 plus alpha over 2 pi, and this part is called the anomalous, not to be confused with those anomalies, anomalous magnetic moment of the electron, or of whatever the particle is. The muon has an anomalous magnetic moment as well. So this kind of quantity would be given by an expectation value here that would be of the type 0 j mu psi 1 and psi 1 bar, like so. If you computed this, the leading term would be that, and the subleading term would be this. And the subleading term gives you that value. And you've now just had two quantum field theory lectures in the space of 5 minutes. This is a hard calculation. This is not a trivial calculation. Have any of you ever done it, or at least seen it? You've seen it, and you've seen it, right? Am I right? Is it painful? Yeah, really painful? Pretty painful, right. So now it's not, you know, I mean, of course, you guys are used to pain. That's why you came here. But, but I'm just saying that the context of this is similar to that. And I am asking now, how do fermions interact with a normal magnet? Now, if you like, I'm asking, how would photons interact with some funny axial charge? Yes.
Like kinematically.
In this context, yes. In this context, I'm saying this is some macroscopic non-quantized source that quantum stuff is interacting with. Of course, if you get down to a fundamental microscopic level, everything is interacting microscopically with everything else. But to average over what the magnet's doing, I mean, no one's ever done it, to my knowledge. So in some sense, when you have... like up there in this diagram here, when you have this kind of thing going on, this is like a little magnet, this is like a little magnet. So in some sense, there is a tiny thumbprint of what's going on there in this process, but it's so overwhelmed by other things that it's difficult to pick out that particular feature. Whereas here, this is experimentalists can measure this clear as a bell. It's not an easy experiment, but it's known. And this, this is what I said last time about the 13 decimal place precision. This has been calculated to 5-loop order. And these guys that have done one loop know it's hard. 5-loop order. There are hundreds of thousands of diagrams to compute. And the guy that did it is named Kinoshita. He's at Cornell, and his whole life has been spent calculating that process. Is that worth it? Well, I don't know. He has a job, right? So, anyway, that's so what happened, of course. I really want to get to the other stuff. What happened was in the early 1950s, people realized that this kind of thing should happen if Feynman, Schwinger, and Tominaga were right, and Schwinger actually calculated this correction. And then people measured it, and they thought, hey, that's one of the things that convinced people of quantum field theory, is this agreed with the measured value of the electron magnetic moment and not that thing. So then what spurred on the industry is they thought, okay, well, this idea of subtracting infinities is pretty screwball. It's going to mess up at the next order. So they calculated that, and it didn't. Well, it's going to mess up at the next order. So they calculated that, and they didn't. Remember, the number of diagrams grows factorially with the order of the coupling. So we are still in a state where there is perfect agreement within limits of error, 13 decimal place for the electron in QED theory and experiment. The upside or downside is the muon. It does not agree. It's in disagreement in the last few decimal places, well outside the limits of error. No one knows the reason why at this point in history. There's been a lot of work done on it. There are jobs there, because we don't get it. But really, we don't. We do not know that. It agrees to about, I think, 9 decimal places, but the last 3 are way off by limits of error. And no one knows the reason why right now. So if you replace this electron, good, muon, bad. Let's get back to this. I hope that's not too advanced for you. All right. So, I like to leave as much of this for you to see. So we want to now look at this for the same rationale, the same reason that we, the same reason that people looked at this process. And what will happen is the following. What do we expect? We expect, I need this down a bit. Still not used to these silly buttons. So d mu j mu 5, we just proceed naively. Look, this thing is conserved. So therefore, we since d mu j mu 5 equals 0, that suggests that d by dx 0 mu of gamma, this gamma thing I defined, mu nu lambda, should also equal 0. In other words, if I take the divergence of this current, which I've called this space-time point x0, the x0 divergence of this whole thing had better vanish. I also expect that the normal electric current is conserved. So that means that dx1 nu of that thing should equal dx2 lambda of that same thing, and those guys should both be 0. So in other words, this is conservation of normal electromagnetic current, and this is conservation of the axial current, as it's called, j mu 5. In momentum space, this tells me that P0 mu, gamma mu nu lambda is 0. And this tells me that P1 nu, gamma mu nu lambda equals 0 equals P2 lambda, gamma mu nu lambda. So in other words, if I Fourier transform this, a derivative turns into a multiplication by a momentum. And so the conjugate momentum of this contracted to that has to be 0, and likewise for the other two. So what is this diagram? Well, this diagram is minus I. I'll raise the indices now. It's, let's see. I've got one loop momentum, so I've got a d4k over 2 pi to the fourth. And then I have a fermion loop. So let's see. I would have, from the J mu 5, I'll have a gamma mu gamma 5. Then I'll have that fermion propagator, which is I over K slash. Then I'll have the normal current, psi bar gamma mu psi, right there. So I will have gamma nu. And then I'll have, let's see, if the momenta are flowing in, if K is going this way, then down here is K plus P1, right? Yes. Yeah, that this is x1 is this variable.
Sure. So how does that correspond to conservation of current?
Okay, I've suppressed some detail, but if you what has to be true in this time-ordered product, time-ordered product, when you work out the Wick expansion, these two things are going to couple. This is going to couple to a psi bar psi, and so is that. And that forces those relationships on you.
And that's
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So the second guy will be, where was I? The second guy will be a K slash plus P1 slash on there. And then I'm going to have a gamma lambda. And then I'm going to have an I over K slash plus P1 slash plus P2 slash. And then I'm going to get back to where I started. So that means this whole thing is going to be a trace over all that stuff. And I've got a coupling of E squared, and I've got negative 1 because that's a fermion loop. And I think that's all the stuff that's in there. And then, of course, I have the cross diagram, which is exactly the same thing, except I interchange P1 and P2 and nu and lambda simultaneously. And I don't want to recopy all that stuff, but that's what I get. So the object of the game, what people did now, or this exercise, is to see, okay, are those things true for this diagram? And we will see the answer is no. They are not. Now, one can do this by grinding this out by brute force and checking it. But there is a shorter argument. If I wrote it, how much in the way is this thing? Can I write over here? Yeah? Okay. So there is a shorter argument by Adler and Rosenberg. And it goes like this. This thing in momentum space has to be a function of P0, P1, and P2. And furthermore, the sum of the momenta have to add to zero. So P0 plus P1 plus P2 mu equals zero. And so gamma mu nu lambda is really a function only of the two photon momenta. And now what could it be? Well, we know there's a gamma 5 in here. And how familiar are you guys with Dirac holology, traces of gamma matrices? Thumbs up? Good? Okay. So we know that the trace of gamma 5 vanishes until you get to 4 gamma matrices or 8 or something. So this and the trace of gamma 5 with 4 gammas has to give an epsilon tensor. So every term in this thing has to have an epsilon tensor. Furthermore, it's got to depend on P1 and P2, and by dimensionality, there are only so many ways it can depend on it. So one possibility is this. All of these indices are on the epsilon tensor. That's one possibility. A second possibility is that some of the indices are on the momenta, and there's no reason to bias one photon over the other, so we're going to put that in a minute. But then I've got epsilon tau sigma mu lambda, P1 tau, P2 sigma. And then the third possibility is that I've got C1 P1 lambda plus C2 P2 lambda epsilon tau sigma mu nu, I think I wrote, yes, P1 tau P2 sigma. And this is the most general tensorial structure that you can write down, let me put it up a bit, that satisfies the fact that it can only depend on two momenta. It then that it has to have an epsilon tensor in it. It's either linear in the momenta, in which case this is the only choice, or that. I should actually qualify A's, B's, and C's are functions of the momenta. They're not constants necessarily. They could be functions of the momenta, but they would have to be scalar functions of the momenta. P1 squared, P2 squared, or P1 dot P2. They'd have to depend on it like that, which really means they're only functions of P1 dot P2, because P1 squared and P2 squared are zero for the photons, right? So that's the start of the tensorial structure, but we don't stop there. We have Bose symmetry, which tells us that gamma mu nu lambda of P1, P2 had better be the same thing as gamma mu lambda nu of P2, P1. We can't tell the photons apart from each other, so they sure as heck better obey that relationship. And when you put, sorry about that, when you put this into that structure there, you find that A1 of P1, P2 is the negative of A2 of P2, P1, and B1 of P1, P2 is the negative of C2 of P2, P1. And then you find that C1 of P1, P2, probably no surprise at this stage, is the negative of B2 of P1, P2. So this is not hard to do. Just demand this and shove it into there, and you'll find that the A's and B's and C's are related to one another. All right, so now let's require P1 nu gamma mu nu lambda equals zero equals P2 lambda gamma mu nu lambda. Let's require this and see what happens. Well, what happens when you do that, it's not hard to check, is that A2 is negative B1 of P squared minus B2 of P1 dot P2, and A1 is equal to the negative of C2 P2 squared minus C1 of P1 dot P2. Now, if the photons were on shell, I would set these to zero. In other words, if they came from some distant source, they were plane waves, they'd be massless, I'd set them to zero. But I might imagine this is embedded in some other diagram, and so these are not necessarily on shell. So I'm not going to set them to zero at the moment. I could, but I'm going to get the answer even if I don't. All right, so okay, all of this is fine. So we find the A's, B's, and C's are not all independent of each other. We have only three independent functions, and here we have another couple of constraints. So now let's look at the axial thing. Well, let's just, I don't know if it's zero. What I get when I do it is I'll get minus A1 minus A2 of P1 tau P2 sigma epsilon tau sigma nu lambda. And that's all I will get. Why is that? Well, I've got this constraint up here that the sum of the momenta has to be zero as it's flowing in. So as a consequence, if I take the dot product of P0 with the first line, it's going to be minus P1, P2, and the only survivors will be the P2 term here and the P1 there. But over here, if I dot this, if I dot P0 into the mu index, this is going to be minus P1 plus P2, and the epsilon will kill it. And likewise down here, by anti-symmetry, there's only two independent momenta, so I can't contract anything more onto there that depends on P1 and P2. Here I can, so I get this. But now I have these things. So this is equal to B2 minus C1, P1 dot P2, plus C2 P2 squared, plus B1 P2 squared times epsilon nu tau, what have I got here, lambda sigma nu tau lambda sigma P1 tau P2 sigma. I've switched the indices around with signs. That's what you get from the arithmetic. And what, so now all you have to calculate from the diagram are the B's and the C's. And they are, by dimensionality, finite pieces of the diagram. They go like the cube of a P. There's three P's in there. So what you can do is raise this, just put these in the numerator. 1 over k slash is k slash over k squared. Just find the part that depends on three P's and extract out B2 and C1. B1 and C2, and in fact, they are not independent of each other. I suppose I could use this relationship here to get rid of B2 and get rid of C2 if I liked. But the story is, this is not zero. Oops. This is not zero. What it turns out to equal is negative 2e squared. This is the part of the calculation I'm not doing at the moment. And so this is the anomaly. In other words, this identity that should be satisfied up there, the P0 identity, is in fact not satisfied. I guess I've got it here. In other words, this thing is not zero, it's equal to that. So to get from here to here, I haven't shown you that. I've just told you that if you want to find these coefficients, you'll have to do it by expanding out that graph, that integral, and picking out the pieces that are cubic in the p's. And then when you do it, you get a finite integral in all cases, and it works out to be e squared over 2 pi squared when you calculate it. So this is called the chiral anomaly. And it's intrinsic to every graph in here. I've got a lot of details about how to do some of the dirty work, which I'm not going to have time for in the last 8 minutes. So I'm not sure how to deal with that at the moment. But this argument follows simply by saying, gamma has to depend on epsilon in this way due to parity. I've used momentum conservation and I've used Lorentz invariance. That's all I've used to get this answer. And if you want to violate one of those things, then you can get out of this. But if you don't, then you're stuck with this thing. Well, it's not going to be canceled by higher order diagrams because they'll go like more powers of E. Any higher order diagram will have more powers of E. In fact, there is something called a non-renormalization theorem that tells you that there are no higher order corrections to this at all, curiously enough. This is it. All other loops have no effect on this quantity. It's a one loop effect. Curiously enough. What can I say in the remaining few minutes here? Well, you were right about how long this takes, Debra. In terms of this material, let me say a little bit about what I've got some more technical details, which maybe I could talk with Tibra about how to communicate to you. But let me say a little bit about how stuck we are with this thing. And the answer is we really are stuck with it. And the reason is the following. Just a sec, yeah.
One question. We assume here like the conservation of the current holds quantum mechanically, right?
Well, I've asked, does it? And I found the answer is no. In other words, if I wanted this current to be conserved quantum mechanically, this, this, and that would have to be zero. And I've discovered I can get two of them zero, but not this. That's what that's what happens, right?
We just assume that I can set two of those to zero and find the chiral anomaly, right? But
yes.
I can guarantee that I can set those two to zero.
Yeah, so that's what I'm getting to next. You're right. So so one might ask, well, okay, when you say there's no guarantee, what I would say is this. I have found by brute force I can get these I can require this, but the price I pay is that. But you might ask, well, all right, what if I require this to be zero and I want to sacrifice gauge invariance? In other words, maybe I want to build a theory that has an axial current that's conserved, but I don't care if the gauge current is conserved. And the answer is you're not allowed to do that. And the reason for it is that if you consider this product, just take the product of three of these things, which would be a diagram something like this. It would be like having three blobs of axial charge interacting with each other. Then if you ever attempted to couple this to a gauge field, you would find you could not do it consistently because you basically have exactly the same argument. You can construct a gamma like this, and each of the p's would do it, and you cannot get all three to be satisfied, no matter what you do. So the reason is there are three gamma fives. There's a gamma five at each vertex. You can slide them through to get one gamma five. So you could always conserve at two, but you'd mess up the third. Or you could non-conserve them equally or something. But no matter what you do, you are in big trouble. It turns out that if I call this, let's say I've got some momentum flowing in like so, then I would find, let's call this thing gamma tilde mu nu lambda. Then I have P0 mu gamma tilde mu nu lambda is equal to minus, if you partition it out evenly, and there's no reason to do it otherwise by symmetry, then you get this, and you find if you cycle P0, P1, and P2 through each other with the indices, you'll find you get a minus 1 over 6 pi squared for that. So I'm basically almost out of time. There are a number of other technical things in here that I'm not sure how these will be dealt with in a tutorial or something. I do have something in these notes about how to actually grind through some of the issues in this diagrammology, but the short story is you cannot get rid of this thing. The only way to get rid of it would be to have more particles. The only way to get rid of it would be to say, okay, I had one particle in here with a certain charge. What if I have more particles with different charges? Can I get all the charges to add up such that, remember, every particle in that loop will give something like this. But if I have more charges with different signs or something, maybe I could get this thing to cancel out. And the answer is yes, that does work. And that, it turns out, the standard model has that constraint, and we'll see that unfold in subsequent classes. So here, I guess we have to stop here, but I'll talk to Tiber about how to make the technical details available, but I do have a number of other technical details in these notes about how to calculate these things. It's just I don't have time to write them down right now. Yeah.
What if you promote it to a local symmetry so you have another gauge boson?
That's worse. It's not renormalizable. And you might say, well, this is sort of a weirdo artifact, except the real world has differences between left and right-handed particles. And the weak interactions actually do couple to an axial current. And it turns out, as I said, in our world, the quark and lepton content is such that these evil diagrams, each one gives a contribution, but the sum of them together add up to zero. And that was, when discovered, regarded to be a salient fact that any unified theory has to obey. And what happened in late 83, early 84, is Green and Schwartz were playing around with strings and asked what would this kind of calculation look like in the context of string theory. And they found an anomaly. And then they asked, well, what could make it cancel? And then they discovered that it wasn't just the particle content, it was the actual symmetry group that had to be constrained. And this started an explosion of interest in the subject 30 years ago this month, February 1984. I was at the conference where it happened in Chicago, and the people went nuts. So that's a whole historical aspect. So no one had ever seen that happen before. Now the reasons for doing string theory, that reason has sort of faded into the background from what I can tell, but that's what motivated it. Prior to that, nobody cared about strings. Except Green and Schwartz. Yeah, somebody had a question? It's like being in a dentist's office where the guy's going with the drill. Okay, so I'll see you tomorrow.